Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Koval here with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Today, editor of the Times Literary Supplement, Peter Stoddard, talking about a new work from the current Nobel Prize for Literature holder Doris Lessing. Also, the prospect of a woman poet laureate in Britain in the 340-something years since Britain started appointing a poet laureate to the Royal Court. They've never given the accolade to a woman. Maybe this might change. Maybe pigs will fly. And a book that explores the controversial figure of American politics, Henry Kissinger. And we'll hear from a man who's described as the father of the graphic novel, English writer Neil Gaiman. He's going to discuss working across books, comics, films and all manner of media forms. And more from the letters of Jane Austen today, her views on fashion, the theatre, her books and the trials of polite society. Time to welcome once again eminent editor of the TLS, the Times Literary Supplement, Sir Peter Stoddard. Welcome to The Book Show on ABC Radio National, Peter.
Great to be back.
Now Peter joins us from our studios in London, and we're going first to the latest novel from the current Nobel Prize winner for literature, Doris Lessing, who recently said that winning the Nobel Prize was a complete disaster and that instead of pursuing her first love of writing, her life was constantly disrupted by media requests. She's a very grumpy woman, this woman, isn't she?
Yes, but I think she's got quite a lot to be grumpy about. Some sympathy with Lessing. I mean, it's a classic thing, though, the celebrity who complains that they, you know, getting the interviews and then complains even more when no one calls. But that's really not true in her case. And I think increasingly not true in a lot of writers' cases. And this notion that, you know, you become public property when you win a prize. There are so many prizes, obviously Nobel, the biggest one. It's a very, very heavy burden. And I think if you see Doris Lessing around town, of course, you now we do see her much more about town, which I'm sure she doesn't like. She does look as though she'd rather be somewhere else. And frankly, I believe her.
Well, you've got a review of her new novel, Alfred and Emily, in your pages. Tell us about this book. I mean, it continues a thread that will be familiar to readers of Doris Lessing's earlier books because she, I suppose, modelled Alfred and Emily on the Martha Quest books and the people there.
Yeah, I think one of the best, one of the most beautiful things about being a writer is the ability to constantly reconstruct your own life, particularly in old age, and perhaps particularly when you're being sort of hounded by people asking you stupid questions all the time. So you can almost sense the relief of this book. She's sort of back not only writing a novel, this is a very fine novel, but also back on her own real ground. And yes, it's an extraordinary thing. It takes her two real-life parents, Alfred and Emily. And as you say, the Emily is very much the model for the Martha Quest mother. And it was extraordinary, you know, certainly the first real bitter account of a mother-daughter battle that I ever read, and I think many people ever read, you know, extraordinary in its sort of viciousness, crudity and honesty. The father we knew a little bit about too, the First World War veteran, who goes back home and nobody cares about his war experiences anymore. Familiar experience, I think, in England and later in Australia too, but this is set in an African setting. And she tells the real story, and then she imagines the life that they might have had. And it is very, very beautiful the way she does that. And as I say, just for me reading it, it isn't just a beautiful story of a reimagined life of real people. In the end, our reviewer compares it to sort of the novel that D.H. Lawrence might have written about his own parents after Sons and Lovers. But it's also a wonderful thing for her to do, I think, and I just think it just makes you feel better about Doris Lessing and for Doris Lessing that this book exists. It's a very fine thing.
Except she says in this book, I hated my mother, and the process of reinvention of both her parents here seems to be both a wish that her own life had been different and a powerlessness to change her parents' lot in life. To be still working through this at 88 years of age about how she hated her mother, it's pretty strong stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, but none of us can do anything about our past, but writers can recreate them and reinvent them in other ways. And the rest of us, I suppose, if we don't have that gift of fiction, just have to look for some sort of closure, or whatever the modern phrase is, which is, I think, probably a great deal less satisfying, certainly, than that wonderful ability to change it. I mean, I don't think we should be quite as negative as you are about that. Okay, she's still hung up about her mother. That would be that if she wasn't a writer and just was in your psychoanalyst chair.
Yes.
But here she is, a great writer, able to make constant changes in that life and in her life and her parents' life. I'm more positive about it than you are.
But interestingly, in this alternate world that she creates, not only does Alfred not have to go to war, because the war never happens, he also never marries Emily, though they remain close friends. So in effect, she writes herself out of history because they don't have children together.
Well, again, if you're putting the author in the analyst's character, and I'm sure every Freudian, and I live in a street full of Freudians. I live near Freud's house.
We're very in Hampstead or somewhere.
Yes, you can't go out in Hampstead on my street without making someone who will give you a much more fuller answer to that question than I can. But yes, of course, the idea to destroy, to pretend that you never exist and create a reality when you didn't exist is a powerful notion. But again, it's a powerful notion that's barred from most of us.
Yes.
And permitted to Doris Lessing. And as I say, good luck to her still doing it now and getting off the party circuit and off the airwaves, which, as I say, she shows no signs of enjoying.
Well, Doris Lessing's new book is called Alfred and Emily, and it's published in Australia by Fourth Estate. Now, talking of ladies who've won the Nobel Prize, I wanted to talk to you about a female poet laureate, because Britain has been appointing poet laureates for 340 years. The first was John Dryden in 1668, and there have been 22 of them since then, all of them men. But I read that there are moves afoot to force the issue. Poet laureates, of course, used to be royal appointments. Now they're the province of governments of the day. So what do you think the reasons are, Peter Stoddart, editor of the TLS? Can you explain why there's never been a female poet laureate?
Well, as you say, well, they were members of the royal household. They were a crown prerogative. The Prime Minister still appoints them under the crown prerogative, and each one was made on an individual basis. We had some very good ones. People always talk of Dryden and Wordsworth and Tennyson. We also had some extremely bad ones. It's a job which many fine poets wouldn't have wanted. I can't imagine Christina Rossetti being particularly keen on being a poet laureate.
What's the gig?
Well, that's the trouble with it. It was a royal toady job to an extent in the past. It's now much worse than that in many ways. It's a kind of government targeted job. It's like being a kind of schools inspector or someone, giving targets for clean beaches in Weymouth. The government, which hates anything, these sort of free institutions, frankly, and it wants the poet laureate to spread the idea of poetry throughout the schools and, disadvantaged parts of Britain, which is probably fine when they first suggest it to you. But I know the cunt poet laureate quite well, and I knew Ted Hughes well. And Ted could more or less do what he liked. He wrote an occasional poem for a royal birthday or to celebrate some national event, slightly archly and wryly, but I mean, he did it with seriousness, and he did it occasionally. Andrew Motion, the current poet laureate for the last 10 years, and I think, thank God for him, it is only 10 years, basically tramps up and down the country, finding it very difficult to turn down invitations to go to the smallest primary school or trade union event that wants him to go, because that's the job that he sort of signed up to. He gets paid a bit more than the butter sack than he used to, but, sort of a few glasses of sherry, which is the old way, but it's still, a kind of below poverty wage. And it's, to my honesty, not really a very attractive gig, as you put it, anymore. And my problem, if I was a feminist just looking for a female poet for the sake of, well, we haven't had one, so let's have one, I would think it was a pretty raw deal, because the job that Carol Ann Duffy or Jackie Kay or Lavinia Greenlaw or any of the poets that are mentioned getting now wouldn't exactly be the job that John Betjeman had.
Yeah, I see that in the Independent newspaper, Jackie Kay, the Scottish lesbian poet, has got the most votes from the general public. How do you reckon that would go? In fact, she's a mixed race Scottish lesbian poet.
Yeah, no, Jackie Kay, she's a fine person. Curiously, of course, she used to live. She was the lover of Carol Ann Duffy, the other, frankly, really the more serious poet who was considered last time when Andrew Motion got it. And it was thought then, or at least the newspapers said, how far is this true or not, God only knows, but said that, you know, it was because of her alternative lifestyle and sort of anti-establishment credentials, not because she was a woman, that she didn't get it. So if Jackie Kay got it, that really would be an irony. It would show that we'd either that we'd come a very long way in the last 10 years, or, as I say, that the job was really not one that Andrew Motion, let alone John Betjeman, would have thought particularly desirable. It is a shame that these jobs could be different, but they've been sucked into the sort of modern world of the state in a way which is, I think, much less attractive than the royal-dominated world in which the poet laureateship started. It actually gives them less freedom. Now, the idea, you would have thought, working in a democratic state, you would have more freedom than working for sort of Charles II or whatever, but in fact, that doesn't seem to be the case. And certainly if you talk to many poets about the job, they would sort of shriek and say, gosh, no, 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 not for me, thank you very much. Just like, the Nobel Prize is causing some problems, but at least you can decide what you do about that. But there are many jobs like that.
I think there's a bit of money attached, I think.
Oh, the Nobel Prize is great for money. Yeah, yes. The Nobel Prize is great for money. Yeah. But women have won that. I must say, if a woman did get it, I think a Scottish woman could be tricky at the moment because Gordon Brown is under enormous pressure in Britain, our Prime Minister, for favouring too many Scots. So I think he might want to avoid that. But if a Scottish woman did get it, and I was writing a Scottish woman writing in a Scottish newspaper, I'd say, oh, yes, great, they ruined the job, they increase it to nothing, and then they give it to a Scottish woman.
Okay. I'm speaking with Peter Stoddart, editor of the Times Literary Supplement on ABC Radio National on The Book Show. Now, let's just finally talk about Henry Kissinger, because he's, of course, one of the most controversial and criticised figures of American politics during the 20th century. He was Secretary of State from 1973 to 1977 under President Richard Nixon, and simultaneously held the position of National Security Advisor. One of the most savage critiques about him came from Christopher Hitchens, who accused Henry Kissinger of having, I quote, ordered and sanctioned the destruction of civilian populations, the assassination of inconvenient politicians, the kidnapping and disappearance of soldiers and journalists and clerics who got in the way, unquote. But you have a new book that you're reviewing, Jeremy Suri's book, Henry Kissinger and the American Century. How has he approached the topic differently, Peter?
Well, just as if you're a novelist in your old age, you can reinterpret your own life and your own origins forever and ever. If you are a distinguished and controversial statesman, you may not want to do it yourself, but other people are damn sure going to do it for you. And the interesting thing about this Suri book, which Neil Ferguson picks up in the TLS very strongly, is his analysis of why people picked on Henry Kissinger so much. I mean, Ferguson's point is that if you're looking for American secretaries of state who sanctioned, you know, illegal interventions in democracies and assassinations and murders and there are hundreds of thousands of people being killed in Central America, you know, you could have had a trial of John Foster Dulles and you could have had a trial of Dean Rusk and you could have a trial of, you know, many other. Some people might consider that there's some modern examples you might end up having trials of. But somehow Henry Kissinger really gets it in the neck time and time again. I'd always thought that was because just at the time, you know, it was in the 60s and 70s when people were beginning to be much less respectful and he became a character of that age. But Ferguson, who's a historian of the Rothschilds, has been reading through all these documents in the Kissinger papers, which are absolutely immense, and finding constant sort of echoes in his mind of the way in which the Rothschilds were treated. And he thinks that Kissinger's Jewishness was a kind of magnet and a focus for criticism, not anti-Semitic criticism, but criticism by Jews and non-Jews, but it was the line down which so much of the most electric and acidic criticism of Kissinger flowed. And it's an interesting analysis, and Suri's book makes quite a lot of this too and goes back more than other books on Kissinger have done into Kissinger's origins in Germany. He was called Heinz, born in Bavaria, born to a school teacher, the classic sort of small German Jewish family whose life was totally disrupted.
And made him develop a very bleak view of the world, which he carried with him. And the idea is that this forced his mind to, I mean, think that everything was going to hell in a handbasket very urgently and something had to be done.
Yes, and that is, I mean, there are parallels with that today, this notion that I've seen evil and that this justifies my words, my thoughts and my actions is very similar in many ways to a lot of the reactions post 9/11. The notion that if you're absolutely face to face in your life with something that is evil and inexplicable and alien, this justifies a complete kind of re-cranking around of your view of the world. This, I think, quite similar to what is going on in many places now, which is not to equate, you know, Nazism with Al-Qaeda. It's much more complicated than that. But to say that the effect on the individuals who are confronted with it may have some of the same effects on seeing this world in black and white, very bleak terms. I think it did come, Sirer's book and Ferguson's review make it quite clear how this came, or argue strongly that this came from Kissinger's origins and the way in which people treated him subsequently. I mean, this is not the last word on Kissinger. Ferguson himself is deep in these archives. The TLS, I'm sure, will... Christopher Hitchens is one of our great writers. We have many other writers on the TLS who I'm sure will be appalled by this review, but no one's ever accused the TLS of having a party line on this or on anything else.
Well, Jeremy Suri's book is called Henry Kissinger and the American Century, and it's published by Harvard University Press. And we'll put the link to the TLS website and a link to Peter's blog on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. And we'll put the details of the books we've been speaking about with Peter today on the website. Peter Stoddart, editor of the TLS, always a pleasure speaking with you.
And always good to talk to you.
You're with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval. Neil Gaiman has been described as the father of the graphic novel. The English writer, who's been crossing media forms for decades, has certainly developed an enviable reputation as a trailblazer. But he's the first to acknowledge that this accolade is usually the product of wonderful collaborations with illustrators and film directors and even other writers like Terry Pratchett. Neil Gaiman has written fantasy, horror and high-tech stories for adults and young adults and children. And sometimes it's hard to know which book is intended for which audience, and he likes it that way. His literary life started as an enduring collaboration with artist Dave McKean, but he's unable to stay still, jumping between different forms and different media because he never wants to repeat himself or try to compete in any conventional way with 3,000 years of traditional storytelling. Michael Shirriff spoke to Neil Gaiman during his recent trip to Australia and asked him why he was always taking on new styles and new problems.
I like challenges as a writer. I'm the kind of writer that tends not to start out by going, I would like to do one of these because lots of people have done these. The idea of just being allowed to go wherever I want, the idea that, okay, the next thing, if the next thing I have an idea for is a film script, then I'll write a film script. If it's a poem, I'll write a poem. If it's a short story, I'll write a short story. If it's a radio script, I'll go off and write a radio script, subject only really to the constraints of time and the real world. But what I love doing is telling stories. But what I then love doing is looking around at the innumerable ways of telling stories that are available and going, all of these are new disciplines. All of these are things that I can learn. All of these, it's like those old-fashioned sweet shops which had those huge bottles filled with wonderfully coloured sweets. And I kind of feel like I'm one of those kids who's been lucky enough to be locked in a sweet shop all night. And I just want to get my hands into as many of those bottles as I can before they open the door in the morning.
And you've had way too much sugar.
Much, much, much too much sugar. And brightly coloured sugar. So there's probably food colourings and all sorts of things in there.
It's interesting, though, that I look at some of your books and I think, in a strange way, you've circled back on that storytelling tradition that perhaps you avoided in the first place, that you... if not treading in the same footsteps as the traditional storytellers, you're walking alongside them.
I think that's true.
I mean, books like Coraline are very much in that tradition.
Oh, absolutely. And much more so even with the next book. There's a book called The Graveyard Book, which comes out this Halloween. The idea for it was something that I had over 20 years ago. We used to have a very tall, spindly house with no garden. And my son was about 2, and in order to let him ride his tricycle, I'd go to the graveyard next door, and he'd just ride his tricycle between the gravestones. And I remember thinking one day, I thought, you know, you could do Kipling's The Jungle Book and set it in a graveyard and make it about, instead of being about a kid in a jungle being raised by animals, being taught the things that animals know, I'd have it about a kid being raised by dead people, being taught the things that dead people know. And it's one of those ideas you go, I think that's a real idea. I think it's a real book, and I don't think I'm good enough to write it. And as the years went on, I kept putting off because I didn't think I was good enough to write it. And then a few years ago, I thought, you know, I'm not getting any better. I may as well just do it. And at that point, you're very intentionally working within a very classical mold. And I think I'm probably fundamentally a very classical writer. I'm just a classical writer who likes exploring different modes of storytelling. But it was absolutely fascinating for me building the story and doing a couple of stories that actually echo stories in the Jungle Book, and one story which turned into something that almost echoes P.L. Travers, the old Mary Poppins stories. And it's very solidly in the tradition of children's literature and English children's literature. Having said that, the only thing that I'm certain of is the next book I write will be very, very different from that.
That idea of an English tradition, you and I are pretty much the same age, so I didn't grow up reading your books, but I think we probably grew up reading very similar books, because there's a certain English understatement in a lot of your writing, which is interesting that you live in America now. But I'm wondering about the sort of children's stories that had that edge that fed into your writing.
I think I grew up at a really, really good time for children's fiction, because I grew up at a time when you had the Puffin books busily reprinting everything good they could find, you know, so which would mean that you'd read everything from C.S. Lewis and P.L. Travers, and you get these odd books like Noel Langley's The Land of Green Ginger, or books like Buttersnipes and Gumballs, all of this stuff that would just be, you'd have to go looking for it to find it now.
There's one that I've got called The Weird Stone of Brisingham and
Alan Garner.
And it's a beautiful book, but no one's ever heard of it.
It's absolutely that, and Elidor, I think, was the sequel to that. Beautiful books. And again, it's exactly that kind of stuff. It was just there for you at that age growing up. And I was also lucky in that I went to a school where, looking back on it, what obviously happened was the school had some money to buy books with in about 1910, and they got a little more money again in 1930 and a little more money in 1950, which meant that as somebody who used to go and read what was in the school library for pleasure, I wound up with a knowledge of Edwardian fiction, Edwardian children's fiction, that sort of, normally I think you'd have to go to university to find that kind of stuff. But I think what was really interesting for me is, especially with children's fiction, children bring so much of themselves to what they're reading. And there's probably two different kinds of children's fiction. There's the stuff that was amazing and important to you when you read it when you were 7 or 9. And then you pick it up when you're 30 and you go, that was the best book in the world. And you open it and you get 5 pages in and you realize it was all you. And then sometimes you go back to books and you discover they're better than you thought and that there was more going on. And occasionally you'll go in and realize that there's a whole another stream in the book for adult readers.
One of the things that you mentioned before, which is a major part of probably most of your work, is the idea of collaboration. And a lot of people can't collaborate. They find that restrictive. They find it hard to find someone that will understand their idea. But for you, you're working very much in visual storytelling. A lot of the time it's been with illustrators. And so you mentioned Dave McKean.
I was a young journalist when I met Dave. And we met in the offices of a comic, a magazine that was going to come out, we were told, and it slowly became apparent that it was never going to come out. But a guy called Paul Gravett from Escape magazine came to do an article on this comic and liked what I was writing and liked what Dave was drawing and asked if we'd like to do something together for him. He said, could we do a 5-page strip for Escape magazine? And we went to see him 2 weeks later and said, would you mind if we did a 48-page original graphic novel called Violent Cases instead? And bless him, he said, no, go right ahead. And so we did that for him, and we were halfway through, and some people from DC Comics came over on a talent scouting expedition. So I pretty much bent Dave's arm back behind his back and frog-marched him up to London and muttering, they don't want to see us, you know, they're only doing this to be polite the whole way. And we went in and walked out of there with a commission for Black Orchid, which was our first graphic novel. And when I did Sandman, Dave did every single cover for 75 issues. And we'd done a lot of stuff since then. We did a thing called Mirror Mask, which was enormously fun, which was a children's film where we got contacted by the Jim Henson Company, who said films like Labyrinth and The Dark Crystal have proved tremendously popular over the years, although they were considered flops when they came out. They've lasted forever on video and now on DVD. And we'd like another one. The only problem is that those cost about $40 million when they were done, and we have $4 million. Can you guys do something like that for $4 million? And Dave McKean said yes. So he and I sat down. He had a story. I wrote a script to his story, and he then went off and directed this absolutely peculiar, wonderful, hallucinatory film, which was Mirror Mask. And we still love working together.
Was that something about the innocence and naivety of people in the book world heading into the film world and not seeing the boundaries?
I think there was a level on which that was true. I'm quite convinced that if somebody had actually sat down and explained to Dave McKean, not really to me, I was like the father in this. I had, you know, 2 weeks of enormous fun writing a script and then left it to Dave. Dave then had a two-year gestation period for the last 8 months of which he got practically no sleep, was more or less living in the film studio with a team of animators and essentially doing the impossible.
That's another thing about writing. There's a certain simplicity about the words on the page. There's a comment that you made about the making of Stardust, which was another film that came out last year based on your book. And you described going into the set where they were building this giant flying boat, which is captained by Robert De Niro in the film. And your overwhelming feeling was guilt.
It's true. It was. I felt so guilty because it's the kind of thing where you're sitting at home and you're thinking, okay, I've just stranded my people on a cloud. How do I get them off? Oh, a flying ship would be nice, and I can get Charles Vess, who was my illustrator on that, to draw a gorgeous flying ship. And this will be lovely. So you write it. It takes you 30 seconds to come up with the idea, a grand total of maybe an hour and a half to write the entire scene, and you've used a fraction of a penny's worth of ink, and that was all it cost. And something magical just happened on the page. Then I went to Pinewood Studios, and I went into Studio H, and these carpenters had spent the previous 8 weeks building a pirate ship at a cost of roughly £2 million. That would, when they were finished with it, be disassembled with sledgehammers. And I got to walk around a pirate ship, and all I could do was just feel guilty. I wanted to apologize to everybody, and I started wishing I'd come up with something simple and easy. And then I started talking to the carpenters and discovered how much they loved getting to build a pirate ship, and a flying pirate ship at that, and realized that actually probably my guilt was slightly misspent. I had the same thing recently in Portland on the set of the Coraline film, where they're doing a stop motion. Henry Selick, who directed The Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach, is directing a stop-motion Coraline film. And it's the biggest stop-motion film anybody's ever done. They've got 43 different sets going on. They've got animators, doll makers.
And stop-motion is painstaking.
On a really good day, they might get 20 seconds worth of usable footage. They started shooting it in March of last year. They are hoping to have it out by its release date of February 2009. And what they're doing is astonishing. And again, I started feeling guilty until I actually did a signing for the various animators and costume makers and doll makers and model makers and people who make the tiny armatures that these things fit on. And I realized that they were all in absolutely seventh heaven. This was what they wanted to do. This was the best thing they could ever dream of doing, and I'd given them that opportunity. And so, again, I felt rather less guilty at that point.
I mean, you've been doing it for years with illustrators too, as you say. Dave had been spending, you know, months working on illustrations of text that might have taken you
seconds to write. Mm. It's true. I felt very guilty recently with a thing called The Dangerous Alphabet, which is a children's book that I wrote that was illustrated by Gris Grimley. And Gris is this wonderful cartoonist and children's book illustrator. And I wrote the poem first, which is a 26-line alphabet thing that's also a sort of a story. And then Gris and I got on the phone and concocted the story that was going to go on in the pictures, because we love the idea of doing a children's book the other way around. Normally, in a children's book, the story is carried by the words, and the pictures amplify and give mood. And we thought it would be interesting to do something in which the story is being told in the pictures, and the words just amplify. Create the mood and amplify and make it odder and stranger and perhaps a little more scary and tricky than it would be otherwise. But in which, if you actually want to know what happened, you're going to have to look at the pictures.
And it's a very different style to the sort of stuff that Dave does. It's much more painterly. I mean, with Dave, you've been playing with a comic and multimedia look, but this is sort of a return to an old tradition of illustration, really.
I don't think I could have got away with doing The Dangerous Alphabet with Dave, because I think one of the things we really wanted was the idea that it was just going to look very classical and look very simple, and you'd have a painted illustration on each page or a drawn illustration filled with alphabetical things from that letter and the story going through. But then again, I say that, and one of the magical things about working with Dave now for whatever it is, 22, 23 years, is he always surprises me. And at the point where I go, Dave wouldn't do something that simple and straightforward, he promptly will do something even more straightforward. And then when I expect him to do something painterly and straightforward, he suddenly does something photographed and run through computers and really peculiar. The oddest thing we're about to do, Dave and I, is postage stamps in England. Dave was commissioned by the Royal Mail to do 7 stamps based on folklore. And then they contacted me and said, would I write a short story about each of these stamps? And they can only be about 100-word short stories to go in the little brochure that they'll bring out. And I thought, what a wonderful opportunity that is to be.
There's nothing like being constrained by the ripply edge of a stamp.
Exactly. And watching Dave having to do paintings of a brownie and a giant and a seahorse and stuff that are absolutely gorgeous and beautiful and much, much more literal than I think he'd like to do, because after all, they're going to be tiny and they're going to be on stamps and people have to be able to look at it and see what it is.
One of the things about Dave's illustrations and your writing, there is a certain sort of gritty edge to what both of you do. The book, The Comical Tragedy or Tragical Comedy of Mr. Punch, which is a sort of a parallel, tells the history of the Punch and Judy tradition, but stems out of a very gritty child experience growing up in a not particularly pleasant family environment in England, being pushed around from coast to coast,
yes,
literally.
Grandparent to grandparent.
Beach to beach. And one of the things that you wrote in there, one of the things that the character says, when I was 4, I believed everything, accepted everything, and was scared of nothing. Now I was 8. And I believed in what I could see and was scared of anything I couldn't, scared of things in the darkness, of things invisible to me. And I wondered whether through all the sort of contemporary styles that you use and that Dave uses, you're still sort of channeling a much more sort of simple childhood uncertainty and fear, whether it's just new tools to perform an old trick.
Kim Newman, who is a writer who I worked with when I was a very, very young journalist, reviewed my novel Anansi Boys, my last adult novel, for The Independent, and said something astonishingly perspicacious. And it's always odd reading reviews and reading critics, because normally you take on board what's being said, but then you throw it overboard immediately. But he said something like, Anansi Boys is one of Neil Gaiman's adult novels, which means it's far less ruthless and vicious and terrifying than any of his children's fiction. And it was the first time I'd ever actually thought about the division between my adult and children's fiction like that. And I thought, you know, it's actually true. Most of my adult fiction takes place in a world which is fundamentally reassuring. And most of my children's fiction takes place in a world that is much more dangerous, in which you are coping with the powerlessness of childhood, in which you're in a world that belongs to other people, much, much bigger than you, and you haven't been given a map, and you haven't been given an instruction book, and it's your job to figure it out as you go along without getting into too much trouble.
An adult imagination is based on things that are known, that they're based on traditions, based on your own experience. A child doesn't have that experience, hasn't got that, as you say, hasn't got the map laid out for them. So, I mean, you know, American Gods and Nancy Boys is telling almost a familiar story against a new backdrop. It's using very familiar types.
And tropes and elements, yes. Whereas I think something like Coraline, for me, the joy of that is there aren't any rules. She goes through a door that ought to be bricked up and it isn't, and she meets her other mother who looks just like her real mother, only she has a white face and long fingernails, and instead of eyes she has big black buttons, and she's really pleased to see Coraline and she wants Coraline to stay with her forever. And Coraline has to cope. There are no rules. It's not something where you're given instructions, and it's not really something that we've ever seen before in fiction. And what then gets funny for me, funny in the sense of peculiar, not funny in the sense of rolling around on the floor, slapping my fists against the carpet, is in Coraline you then had a book that children read as an adventure and adults read as pure horror. And it took me ages to figure out that children were reading a book about somebody like themselves, somebody who had the same, you know, at their height, going up against something scary, and they never had any doubts that she would win. She'd be fine. It was like a James Bond book. You go up against the villain, you will always win.
Or like a game.
Or like a game. But adults were reading a book about a child in danger, and that's very, very different. The new book, the Graveyard book, starts with what's probably the scariest three pages I've ever written. And we have a house in the dark in which a man with a knife has just dispatched three members of the family, the husband, the wife, and a girl, and is walking around the house looking for the baby. And it's absolutely terrifying. And I keep getting adults saying, well, I would never allow a child to read this. And I go, well, I would. I think you're bringing to it your experience, you're bringing it to your terror and your worry and your concern for that baby. A kid reading it knows that's how the story has to begin. You know, it just in the same way that Shere Khan ate Mowgli's parents in the Jungle Book and now wants Mowgli to finish him off, and the wolves are not going to hand him over, because that's how the story has to start in order for it to be a story.
And that's how the tradition runs. Grimm's fairy tales are not pleasant stories.
They aren't, but they're always satisfying.
Writer and one of the original creators of the graphic novel form, Neil Gaiman, speaking there to Michael Shirriffs. The Graveyard book is due to be released in November, published by Bloomsbury. And details of the other books that Neil Gaiman talked about will be on our website, abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. That's where you are on The Book Show. I'm Ramona Koval. We're all on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.